Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Backlog Battle Podcast. This is Alex.
And this is Daniel.
It's election day today. Well, the day of this recording. Obviously, you guys are going to be hearing this the day after the election. So, yeah, that happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's not dwell on it.
I mean, I was actually kind of segue into Street Fighter, because did you know that they have, like, a president, like, as a fighter in Street Fighter V now?
No, I did not.
Yeah, so he kind of looks like Abe Lincoln. He is only called the letter G, and he has a very interesting mechanic. So basically, the way he works is that he is the self-proclaimed president of the world. And I'm not talking about it in a very serious manner. I'm talking about in a joking manner. Like, you know, like, do you know, like, have you ever seen, like, motivational speakers that are so confident and stuff that they can try to convince everybody that, you know, what they're selling isn't, like, you know, snake oil and stuff like that? Like, it's,
yeah,
he's kind of like that, but, like, he has, like, an infectious charisma to him. And check this out. So, he can charge up to 3 levels of a special kind of charge called, get this, this is the actual name, presidentiality. I'm shitting you not. And presidentiality, the max level is 3. When you get, like, level 2 presidentiality, it actually alters his special moves to have different properties. And presidentiality 3 will actually allow you to, like, kick people towards a wall and make them bounce off of it. So that's how powerful his presidentiality is. But yes, like, he basically looks like a buff Abraham Lincoln, which is freaking hilarious. And somehow the election kind of reminded me of it. So I just wanted to share that little tidbit right there in case you...
I gotta admit, that is pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, my hat off to Capcom for that. That's not bad.
And he does have a tall, like, top hat, by the way. And the cool thing is, after he does, like, a special move, if you don't touch any buttons, he'll just do, like, a kind of like a flourish, like, just a flourish animation where he kind of tips his hat down or something, or he does, like, a hey kind of fawns kind of thing. Like, just, it's just random, and I'm like, this is a great character. Like, this is really, really good. Like, he has some style. Like, you know what he reminds me of? He reminds me of, like, the old school Street Fighter 2 characters, like, where we don't really give a shit about, like, you know, where they came from and stuff, and they were just really funky. Like, oh yeah, of course, like, a monster from, like, Brazil with electric powers will fight, like, a sumo wrestler in a bathtub, like, in Japan, you know? Like that kind
in
of crazy
bathtub?
Shit. Well, yeah, because E Honda stage is literally like a public bath in Street Fighter 2.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So, yeah, because when you get to E Honda stage, it's literally like, you know, like a public bath, and you fight him there. Like, it's.
Yeah, but it's not a bathtub.
Well, it technically is a bathtub. It's raised and it has water in it. Like, there's nobody there except him. So, I mean, you can kind of make the argument that it is a bathtub. It's a bathtub
okay,
for
I
one.
I mean, I don't know if that thing is called something else in Japan. Whatever.
Who cares? It's for the visuals of people to paint it using their brains, okay? Like, if we, you know, try to get, like, a highfalutin, like, Japanese name, people are going to be like, huh? What the fuck? Like, but a tub is a very clear kind of, like, okay, yes, I know what a tub looks like. Let me imagine that in my noggin or something. But yeah, so... But yeah, like, G is just kind of like this ridiculous character that, you know, again, like, he just believes in himself so much. And by the way, he has tattoos of the world in both his biceps. And for some reason, it moves and it glows gold. And it also, like, you know, he has, like, the world tattoo also goes in his, like, face. Like, if he's, like, level 3 presidentiality. Dude, you gotta look this guy up. Just, even if you're not interested in Street Fighter V, just to look at this character and just see how ridiculous this is. Like, it's funny because, like, he showed up the same day as Sagat came out. And, you know, for a DLC character. And Sagat was almost just, you know, snubbed immediately because this guy's like, man, this president guy is pretty freaking hilarious. And a lot of, you know, hardcore, like, fighting game fans are, like, kind of picking him up and trying to learn him because he's a very complex character to play, which is, man, you know.
I didn't expect that, but okay.
Yeah. It is, right? It's kind of crazy. Anyways, that's all I'm going to really talk about, like, Street Fighter V. But how are you? Like, you know, be a, like, let's move away from politics, you know, of the world. And,
Yeah, let's get away from that controversial topic.
Let's go into, you know, more sane topics, you know, like that are more grounded, I suppose. Speaking of grounded, you played God of War, right?
I didn't just play it. I beat it.
Yep. You like that segue, given that, you know, like Kratos can't jump in this one. He's grounded. Get it? Get it?
Yeah.
Come on. That was pretty good, I think.
I wish Kratos told Atreus a story, and he's like, boy, I used to double jump. Now I can't jump at all.
Yeah, because of my old brittle bones. Okay, this is slowly turning into, like, freaking George Takei right there, so I'm just going to stop, like, with the questions, you know, because yeah.
But have you beaten the game?
Yeah, oh yeah. I beat it, like, way back in, you know, like, the first month it came out and stuff.
Right, so I put it down mostly because Spider-Man came out and Yakuza Kiwami 2 came out. So they kind of pulled me away from God of War. So took a break from it. And after I finished those two games, I came back and I'm like, all right, let's finish this fucker.
Mm-hmm.
And I did.
Okay. Thoughts?
I think it might be the best God of War game.
Whoa, did not expect you saying that.
You have to remember that my opinion of the original games is not particularly high.
Okay.
I don't think they're bad games per se, but I think they're fine. Right? Like, the first God of War is probably aged the worst. Only has like three bosses. Jesus. But you know, it's fine. God of War 2, it's a better, I think it's like probably the best of the three in terms of like, you know, it's probably the most balanced one.
The four, right? Because we can't forget about Ascension. That did come out.
You know, it's funny. I have Ascension and I played some of it, but I was so bored that I just never went back to it.
Yeah. You and I have the same opinion of that game. I never like, finished
I got to a certain point and I got stuck somehow. Like, which should never happen in a God of War game. Like, in a God of War game, you should always know where you're supposed to go next. And but for some reason in that game, I somehow got stuck. And I was like, man, screw this. I don't care anymore.
Yeah. That's the perils of like PS2 design era kind of stuff, right? Like, obviously, this is a game that came out on PS3. But remember, like, you know, thinking about it, where like the era that it came from, people thought that adding variety to a genre can give it a lot more life and can vary the gameplay parts and the pacing a bit more. But then, you know, that was also the era where they realized that by actually like completely taking away the ability of players to control the pacing, like, for example, like, you know, forcing them to solve puzzles, that completely makes people bored of the game that they're playing, you know? So
I like the puzzles in God of War.
That's good. But, like, you know, there are some people that I remember, like, when I was working at a video game store, they were complaining about the puzzles because it really, they hated that part of it. Which, you know, again, I didn't mind it, but there were certain puzzles, certainly, like, for example, in God of War 1, where there were, like, the, you know, the falling rocks, and you have to push, like, this thing uphill, like, to the point where they're actually dropping. That was just a big fucking pain in the ass. Like,
oh, yeah. I think I remember you talking about it. There's, like, a guy in a cage or something, and you have to kick him up the ramp.
Yes.
And there's, like, rocks, and you have to, like, leave him on the rocks.
Yes.
So that you can fight enemies. Yeah, yes. I remember that.
Yeah.
See, I actually liked that because it's taking what you already know, but it's just, you know, throwing in a twist, and it's, like, making you it's making the player make decisions using the tools that they already have, but like in a different context, if you get what I'm saying.
No, I completely get what you're saying too. I just wish that the penalty wasn't so severe. That's the thing that's kind of the crazy part, because there you could essentially like wind up all the way back down from the very beginning and just, you know, rage.
Yeah, that could be annoying. I hear you.
Yeah, but there is, I'll give you that, but there is something to be said about the creativity of that section, right? Because, you know, it was super risky, but in hindsight, from a practical standpoint, thinking about it, it was like, wow, that's really ballsy, because what other, you know, character action game did something as ballsy as that, you know? Like, probably not a lot.
Well, I think what makes the God of War games successful is their pacing. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is specifically that the games are always throwing something new at you. The games are always doing some gimmick, right? And the games never stay on that gimmick for too long. You know, you have a fighting section, and then you have a puzzle, and you have another fighting section that might have a little twist to it, like the one we were talking before at the ramp, but then it moves on and it's something different. And I think it's because the game developers probably realized that the game could not, like, the combat could not carry the weight of the game on its own.
Yeah.
So that's why they created all of these unique situations so that it keeps the game fresh.
Yeah.
Unlike Devil May Cry, where, you know, not to say that Devil May Cry doesn't have, like, unique situations in and of itself, but the combat carries the game.
Yeah, it's like, you know what I'd like to call this, though, like, Daniel? It's a difference in focus, right? You know, like, this is the focus conversation, in my opinion, is something that is starting to be talked about a lot in the video game industry lately, especially with Red Dead Redemption 2 coming out, right? Like, I don't know if we ever talked about it last week, but, like, you know, in Red Dead Redemption 2's case, I'll just make this brief. Red Dead Redemption 2's case, they didn't really pay attention too much on their gameplay, but the things surrounding the gameplay that will propel different activities from happening. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was Rockstar's focus in that game, whereas other, you know, open world games might focus more on the gameplay aspect of it, like responsiveness and whatnot. You get what I'm saying? So I think that's kind of like what you're describing here. It's a difference in focus between God of War and Devil May Cry.
Sure. I wasn't finished talking about the original games.
Oh, my bad.
So I said that the first God of War, you know, hasn't aged too well, but, you know, it's fine. Second God of War, pretty decent. Third one, I would say it's probably the best in terms of gameplay, but I find the story, or at least Kratos in that game, is so insufferable that it makes me really dislike that game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the reason why I was very hesitant about the God of War reboot. It's more of a soft reboot because the original games are still in continuity.
Yeah.
But, you know, among other things, made me worried about the game going into it. But that was one of the biggest things, where Kratos is this irredeemable piece of crap, in my opinion, mostly because of what he did in God of War 3, and because the events of those games are canon, right? They're still part of the new game.
Yeah.
So one of the things I really appreciated about the God of War reboot was they don't try to make you feel sorry for him. They don't try to make it seem like the things that he's trying to atone for the things that he did, or he's trying to make up for it, or he's trying to turn a new leaf. None of that crap. He's simply a man living with regret. He knows that he's a monster, and he's not trying to, like, win anyone over. He's just trying to make sure that his son doesn't end up as bad as him. That is what I really appreciated, that they tried to not make you feel sorry for Kratos, but rather to empathize with his plight and to make sure that his son grows up right.
Yeah. And let me cut you off right there, because, like, I remember having a conversation with you about God of War several months ago as well, where, you know, you felt really bullish about the direction of God of War, where they're trying to take it. And you kind of felt like it was a little bit ham-fisted to kind of, like, try to also honor the previous games and try to go in this kind of, I think you said, like, it was a strange direction given the previous game's, like, presentation, that now this is, like, this very somber, almost kind of contemplative. I mean, obviously, Kratos is not contemplative, but, like, in comparison to the previous games, it's less mainstream-y, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, sure. You know, hearing this from you, how you've intake the story and the characters is very interesting to me, because, you know, again, like the your previous opinion was coming from a place where you hadn't even tried the game yet. But now that you've experienced the whole thing, like, the bigger picture has kind of been shown to you, which is, to me, really fascinating.
Yeah, I really appreciated the game by the end of it. And I will say that I still had a bunch of issues with it, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But after playing the whole thing and seeing the journey to its end, I was very satisfied. Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, even though I say, oh, this is probably my favorite, at the same time, I don't see myself replaying this game. I can see myself replaying the older games, mostly because they're really short. They're very fast. You know, you could probably beat them in an afternoon or two. While with the new one, it's a long, slow game. And not only that, but certain aspects of the game feel tedious because it's just, it feels like it's wasting your time. And I think it's because of this desire, I guess, to have this oneer with the camera, mm-hmm. right? This desire to have one continuous shot throughout the entire game. Because of that, I feel like they do a bunch of time wasters as ways to mask the loading in the background.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
So like, oh, Kratos will lift up a rock and then he'll put it back down and have Atreus run under it. You know, when it makes more sense for Kratos to just pick up the fucking rock, throw it so he doesn't have to worry about it anymore. But no, he does it like this so that it gives the game time to load up the next area.
So yeah, and we're basically saying, like, from a technical standpoint, all these, you know, quote unquote obsessive, you know, animations and stuff are literally there for, you know, technical purposes, which, you know, it's totally mm-hmm. understandable. And honestly, like, for me, I don't know if I would want to play God of War again, but I'll tell you this, like, this year so far, after playing that game, there have been maybe a couple or so times where I did want to go back and replay it because I feel like there's more to it that I might have missed. Did you even feel that way, like, after finishing the game, that you might have missed something, like, you know, apart from the main story, of course?
Well, I mean, there's some side content I didn't do, obviously. Okay. I didn't go out of my way to do the Valkyries. I did some of them.
Yeah.
And I didn't do all of the side quests. So there is a little bit of a lingering feeling of, like, you know, I could go back and get better gear and, you know, finish those quests.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to another issue. Is the gear.
Mm-hmm.
I think tying your Kratos' level to gear is both baffling and unintuitive.
Okay.
I don't agree with this decision at all. I actually don't agree with having RPG elements at all. I feel like they should have stuck with the more character action approach of the previous games, where you get a currency and you use that currency to learn new moves, you know, and maybe, you know, add some strength modifiers at most. But, you know, and this may sound weird coming from me because I love RPGs, but generally speaking, unless a game is a focused action RPG like a Tales game, when a game tries to be like this weird middleman compromise of a kind of sort of RPG action game, I hate it, because all it does is that it kind of breaks the design of the game. Because what you'll end up having is, like, you'll have these enemies that are like three levels above you that will completely decimate you. Just utterly just kick your shit in. And it's just frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it was a game like Devil May Cry or like the older God of War games, you would be able to take on that enemy. And it's just adding this leveling system, like, especially tied to gear, which again is just unintuitive, because the game has a very poor way of conveying to you how the gear levels up Kratos, right? Because it, 9 times out of 10, when you put on gear, you're going to look at the stats that go up and down. But what the game actually wants you to do is to pay attention to a little red or green arrow next to the overall level. But most people aren't going to notice that. It wasn't until I saw a review of someone pointing that out when I went, wait a minute, what? Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, for me, like, so the way that I saw it, right, is that they're using the gear and the leveling as an artificial way to gate content, right? Because the biggest difference between this God of War and the games that you mentioned before it is that the games you mentioned before are very linear. There is no explorative aspect of it. You literally can just, you just move, you know, you just have a mission, you move forward, you're done, and then you won't move to the next one, and so on and so forth. Or if you want to get more experience, just replay the level again or something like that, right? Like, in this particular case, this was the decision that they made so that that way you're not going to beat, like, you know, one of the things that you need to beat later on, like, within an hour or two of the game being made. That being said, I do see your complaint about how the, you know, how the gear system works. But I think for me, like, I just kind of immediately figured out, like, what kind of style of gameplay that I want. And to be quite honest, like, you know, it is an RPG system, but to be even more clear than that, it is a Western RPG system where, you know, there is a clear difference between the way that JRPGs and Western RPGs actually, you know, deal when it comes to gear, right? In Japanese RPGs, it's literally like, okay, you buy the next gear, you know, that's going to be more powerful than the one you currently have when you get to the next town, right? Like, that sort of thing. In Western RPGs, building sets and actually mixing and matching, you know, like, the perks and advantages or passives that each gear has is integral to your experience of a Western RPG, because that's where you can get, like, different combinations of combos and stuff, which, you know, one of the things you haven't mentioned is the fact that certain special moves are only activated if you, you know, unless you equip them, right? Like, there's certain moves that can only be done if you equip that, right?
Sure.
And that goes into that design of the Western RPG where it's like, okay, well, this attack right here mixes with this gear, mixes with that gear. And so if I just, you know, use those things, then the actual ice damage properties or whatever the fuck, like, it's going to be, like, much higher than it is, you know, that sort of thing. And
sure.
In that sense, I'm not that kind of gamer. Right? Like, I don't actually enjoy that stuff. But I got by enough to understand, like, okay, well, the game is not going to give me gear right away because this is its way of, like, preventing me from advancing the main story somehow, which is arbitrary, but that's the design that they made. That makes sense?
Yeah, I get that. But that's not what bothered me. What bothered me was specifically that your main level was tied to gear.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually like the approach of, like, well, if you have a piece of gear that has, like, this passive ability and you have this other one that has a more active ability and you have to kind of make a decision between the two of which one you really want. I don't mind that. I actually like that. But the fact that Kratos is either going to be level 5 or level 4 because he put on a bracelet, like, come on. Mm-hmm. That did not do it for me at all. I'd rather they just went with it. Like, if you're going to have a leveling up system, it might as well have been a traditional XP system. Even though the game does have XP, but it's used to buy new moves and to upgrade your skills, which, you know, that's fine too. But again, just tying levels to gear, just no.
But think about that though. If you really, you know, if somebody leveled up to level 20 and stuff within the first several hours of the game without getting the gear, then that means, like, any sections that were gated for level 20, you could literally just go in, which would break the progression of the game in a way, right? Like, I mean,
that's their fault for designing it with that in mind in the first place. They could have just designed it in a way where the game didn't have any levels, but they could still naturally gate off certain areas of the game. Like, the one of the things that the game did that I actually really loved was halfway through the game, the Lake of Nine, the water levels recede.
Mm-hmm.
And it opens up more areas, more difficult areas that you didn't have access to before.
Mm-hmm.
They could have just done something like that in a, on a grander scale.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you, certainly. And, you know, I'm not saying that I disagree that, you know, basically what I'm trying to say is that I don't think the experience point system, quote unquote, would have solved the problem. I think it would have actually, like, made it worse. But I think what you and I are saying here is that if there is... if they did something else to prevent progression, you know, like to, so that you're not like experiencing endgame shit, like just by staying in the starting area or something like that, like there probably would have been better solutions, right? Like,
but then again, is that really even such a bad thing? Like, look at Breath of the Wild. Breath of the Wild lets you, if you really want to, you can go straight to Ganon.
That's like apples and oranges at that point. That's kind of like saying, like, well, sure, in Red Dead Redemption, you can fucking just go to, like, the last area and just kick everybody's ass. But that's not how that works. Like, we're talking, you're basically, like,
oh, sure, okay, that was kind of out of left field.
Yeah. I mean, I would compare, like, Zelda to, like, Minecraft at that point because of how open that game is. Like, we're talking a game, like God of War, is being more of a structured narrative experience than Zelda, where Zelda is just like, go wherever the fuck you want.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I don't know if I really like the idea of, like, arbitrarily blocking off areas to the player like that.
I mean, we don't know, at this point, like, we're conjecturing, right? Like, we don't really know, like, what the design or how that game would feel. It's just that I think the takeaway should be that you and I agree that the gear system is kind of not really a good solution, like, not the best solution to this, right? I mean, can we agree to that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I also feel that if you really wanted to, you could probably still circumvent those progress blockers by, like, gaming the system and, like, mid-maxing gear and stuff.
Mm-hmm. But even then, like, you know, with the current design, you can't really do that, because if your levels are tied to gear, then the game is kind of urging you to equip the highest, most powerful gear, because, like, let's say there was a level one, you know, let's say we're trying to boost up our frost abilities, right? And let's say, like, a level one belt actually had, like, you know, I'm just making shit up here, but, like, a level one belt that actually ups your frost by plus 50 compared to, like, the belt at that, you know, at the highest level, which is, like, plus 12 or something like that. You know, like, just because of the nature that you're equipping a level one item, you're not leveling Kratos up to, like, an acceptable level. You get what I'm saying? So there's not really even that, like, perceived quote-unquote customization that Western RPGs have. So either way, there's a lot of flaws with it, you know?
Sure. What you're saying is, like, The game has more control over what gear you get.
Exactly. Which, it's very rigid. It looks sure, flexible, but it's very rigid when, you know, with what it wants you to do, you know?
Sure. But getting away from that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the story. I don't want to spoil anything.
Okay.
You know, that wouldn't be fair to anyone. Because I do think overall, it is a pretty good story, and I do think it is worth experiencing. However, I did have a few issues with it.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, and you actually responded to this on Twitter. So there was one part in particular with Atreus. Now, I'm not going to explain the context, but there is a moment where Atreus's character has kind of like a shift.
A very noticeable shift.
Yes. And actually, someone responded to me saying that Corey Balrog, the director, actually wanted to have more scenes that fleshed out that section of the game, but they were unfortunately cut. They didn't have time to put them in. So yeah, that does make me sad to hear. But, you know, that's what happens with game
development. Yeah.
It would also explain a couple other weird things that happens around that part of the game. Mm-hmm. But my main issue with that shift is that it really does feel like it comes out of nowhere. Atreus throughout the entire game has been a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're suddenly supposed to believe that because he gained this new piece of information, that all of a sudden it justifies his character, you know, completely changing. And then he learns his lesson and then goes right back to he basically, I don't want to say regresses. I don't know if that's the right term, but he basically just goes right back to how he was before.
Yeah.
And the whole thing just feels very rushed and poorly written. And there is one good thing about it. And that is that during this part, Atreus stops listening to Kratos. And when I say that, I don't mean in a cutscene, I mean in the gameplay, because Atreus has a button dedicated to him, the square button.
Yes.
Now, if you aim and tell him to shoot at something, he'll still shoot at something. But while in combat, if you start pressing the square buttons to get him to start shooting, which is a more general, like, hey, shoot whatever enemy you think is the right enemy, mm-hmm. he actually won't. He won't listen, and he actually becomes more aggressive, and he'll like start jumping on enemies and start trying to choke them out instead of shooting arrows like he normally would.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that was great because like you, the player, and Kratos are like on the exact same page, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. You're both like wondering, you know, what's going on? Why isn't Atreus listening to me?
Mm-hmm.
So that was like the one good thing I would say that came out of that section of the game. Mm-hmm. It's otherwise the worst section of the game.
Yeah. Well, the way that I thought of that section, you know, that you described, I call it the Ico section, because in Ico, you know, okay. like really like, you know, like you've had, you know, the whole idea of Ico is like you're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to kind of almost, I don't want to say fall in love with the person that you're trying to save with and stuff, but like you're supposed to be kind of, you know, slowly kind of empathizing with the princess's situation in Ico and stuff. And, you know, when in moments,
you know, I love Ico.
Yeah.
I love that game, so I don't know how I feel about you comparing this section.
But no.
Ico.
No, but hear me out. The more you actually played Ico, the more you feel for the girl that which is your companion, right? If you think yes. about like, you know, many other games where they try this, right? And there's plenty of games that do this. This isn't a new mechanic, right? Like, this is a storytelling technique and a gameplay technique that works extremely well, because you know, during the time when you're playing the first several hours of God of War and you have Atreus and stuff, you have a very specific rapport. And the game is kind of, you know, conditioning you a very specific way to handle Atreus, right?
So actually, it's interesting because, like, let's say you go through a fight and you don't tell Atreus to use bow and arrow. He will actually, afterwards of the fight, he's like, hey, just let me know next time, you know, when you want me to do it, you know, so I can help out.
Exactly.
So it's the game subtly nudging you of like, hey, you know, Atreus is really helpful. You should use him in battle.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a trick, though, because yes. the game wants you to be very mindful that even though, like, you don't have to save Atreus a lot of the time, that he is ever present. And so when the events that you describe happen, it is much more impactful and much more noticeable when they take that away from you. You know,
yes.
much like when in Ico, when the princess is separated from you, now you're like, okay, what the fuck? Like, you know, like there's an emotional kind of context to it, right? Like with that is directly tied to the gameplay.
There is kind of during, I know what section you're talking about. There's like a certain emptiness during mm-hmm. that part of the game, because you're so used to being with that girl, Yorha, mm-hmm.
yeah.
the entire time, or Yorda, rather.
Yeah.
You're so used to being with her all the time and holding her hand and, you know, dragging her along. So that one section of the game where you're separated from her, it feels off.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I get what you're saying.
Yeah. And again, this is, you know, I credit a lot of, you know, a lot of games that kind of have tried to learn from Ico to, you know, to Ico specifically, because Ico was like kind of like this test bed where this is like, okay, we want players to empathize with a character that they're playing with physically. Like, this is a controllable character, but not directly controllable from the player's perspective. Like, they are in the periphery, if you will. There have been many games that have succeeded. I mean, I think Last Guardian succeeds to a degree. God of War succeeds, I think, pretty well. And there are ones that don't, like Bioshock Infinite, which is fucking weird because, you know, they literally made her such a non-crucial part of that game that when some things happen in the story later on, you're just like, were they really there anyway? You know, like, you get what I'm saying? It's like, you know, they were present in locations and stuff, but it's like in fighting, it's like, well, they're kind of there and they can do something here, but visibly they're not there, you know, or maybe they're just not that important because they're invincible, you know. You get what I'm saying? It's like the reason why these characters are so important because they are ever present in the gameplay. Not once do they basically like go back and hide somewhere else, or unless you're Yorda and you are being carried by a bunch of shadow creatures, but even then, that is part of the gameplay. You have to save Yorda, you know? So this is not like the situation where they're just kind of like, oh, they're invulnerable. You don't have to worry about them, but they're important. No, they're not. But yeah, like, so you get what I'm saying. And I feel like, you know, I'm not saying that obviously like Ico is equals God of War, not at all, but the empathy that is created here is lent and lends itself from the original game, in my opinion, that did it pretty damn well for like the PS2. Long way.
No, yeah, definitely. Ico is one of my favorite games, even though it's like not the most fun game to play, but it has such a unique experience. Oh, so yeah. I always carry with it.
Yeah. Oh no, I always like that. Shadow of the Colossus, Last Guardian, to some degree. I still need to finish that game, but like,
you know, I haven't touched Last Guardian, actually.
There's some... We can talk about that some other time, but I feel like there's some pain points because of the way that they've designed that game. But, you know, it is what it is. It's the usual SCEJ jank, if you will. That is weird. Yeah. Anyways. Continue! Interrupted you.
Yeah. So I guess I'll just wrap up with God of War then. Sure. So overall, I think it's a great game, but a very flawed one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's... I do think it was overhyped. I don't think it was quite deserving of all the crazy praise. But in the end, I really liked it. And I am looking forward to the sequel. If the sequel addresses some of the problems that I had with this game, then I feel like the sequel could be a really damn fine game.
Oh, no, I agree with you. Because it felt like God of War, this one, was like a baseline to what they want to do, right? Like, this is like the proof of concept, right? Like, it's like, okay, well, we can't have Kratos jump, right? But here's the kind of customizations you can do. So, to me, like, this is 1.0, naturally, obviously. But, yeah, you're right. I agree with you. Like, if they iterate on this and make, you know, fix the things that you and I have concerns about, this could be an amazing sequel.
I'm really hoping that with the sequel, that they like all the moves that you have unlocked from this first game, they're already available in the sequel, because too many times in sequels they come up with some BS excuse of like, oh, he just suddenly forgot all these moves. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I don't even think like the combat at the end of the game is even like all that complicated, so like I don't think it would be that overwhelming to just keep most of these moves. Like, maybe not every single one of them, but like, you know, did we really need to learn the move to dash attack? I mean, what? Come on. I will say, though, one thing in particular I really want to see in the sequel, this might sound like a weird nitpick, but I want to be able to turn off certain moves. Because what ends up happening in some games is like, and in this one, is you might buy a move thinking, oh, this is a really cool move, but it ends up just kind of getting in your way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a certain attack that you really like to do, But now that attack is not as accessible anymore because you bought this other attack and it kind of gets in your way or something like that.
No, I know what you're talking about. It's kind of similar to when you were complaining about in Bayonetta 2, where like the roll ability is also the same as like the transform into panther ability or something like that, right?
No, yeah.
Yeah, similar stuff. Yeah. No, I definitely agree with you. And I'm guessing based off of what you said, you prefer Spider-Man of the first party games, you prefer Spider-Man over God of War. Am I correct?
No. I'd say God of War is a better game.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, yeah, definitely. God of War is a better game.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I probably had more fun with Spider-Man, like, but I feel like God of War is a better game, if that makes sense.
Well, what is more important to you then? Like, is the fact that the better game, is that something that you find more important than being fun? Or like, I'm trying to basically like measure you here, like, you know.
Yeah, I know, I get what you're saying. See, like, to me, games are more than just like how much fun I had with them.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of see games also as like an experience.
Mm-hmm.
So when I see, like with Spider-Man, I just had fun. But like when I see Spider-Man as an entire package, like it's still really good overall. Don't get me wrong. But like I feel like in the aspects that I feel that it kind of falters, God of War succeeds more in.
Okay.
So like when I kind of look at them as like entire packages, as whole experiences, I think God of War was more consistently good.
Okay.
Even if I found the gameplay itself like probably more viscerally fun in Spider-Man just because it's fun to web swing around and stuff like that. Although I'd say the combat in God of War is definitely a lot better.
Oh,
it's too easy to cheese Spider-Man.
Oh yeah, no, I get you. And I kind of see what you're getting at too. And for me, like that's kind of like something that the reason why I asked you the question is something that I've been laboring for quite a bit, because I'm like, well, yeah, I had a lot of fun with Spider-Man, and most likely if, you know, there's like a new game plus, I'll probably play through it again whenever I finish it. But like God of War, it's like, man, oof, like it felt hefty. You know, like it's like, you know, like for me, like I would go back to God of War just to be super fucking good at the combat. I mean, that's how I feel. I don't know if you feel that same way, because I personally, you know, I felt like during my first playthrough of God of War, I felt like I didn't reach the potential of the combat, if that makes sense. So like, sure. Because I watched other people like play God of War and they do these freaking massive crazy ass combos that I'm like, I don't fucking know like how you guys did this and stuff, because you know, I'm completely like just more focused on getting through like the challenges as opposed to like, oh, you know, this can chain into this and that and da 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 da. Like I wasn't preoccupied with that, but like I would, you know, God of War is one of those games where I'm like, oh yeah, like if you combine all these abilities and stuff, you could do some crazy shit and da 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 and all that. So, and that's kind of like where I'm at with both games, is that God of War does have some really meaty things if you want to get into like the, you know, the combat part of that game. So yeah, that's pretty cool, man. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it a lot more than expected, especially since going into the game. I was expecting it to be not that good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
But
Corey Barlog, man, did it again. Fucking after God of War 2, he did God of War and freaking nailed the winner, man.
You know, I got to hand it to him. He did the two best God of War games.
Yeah, there you go. That's
damn,
yeah. Pretty good, man. So, yeah, it's really cool. But here's the thing that I've been thinking about. And you were in the middle of playing this game before these games distracted you. I was actually thinking of all the first parties that have come out this year and last year. I can't help but think that I enjoyed Horizon more than these two games.
Interesting. So yeah. I was actually thinking of going back to Horizon.
Yeah. And because
I also want to finish East Salceda. So those are the two games right now where I'm like, you know, which one should I go back to? Because I left them both unfinished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think about, you know, like what you said, right? Like the fun part and then the kind of, you know, like the well-developedness of like God of War. And I feel like, you know, if I put Horizon right next to these two, like Horizon strikes a really good balance of being both. You know, like, because to me, like, I love hunting, like, the mechanical creatures and the dinosaurs and stuff. And there's a very specific challenge that's tied into that. And more importantly, I think, the leveling system isn't as borked as God of War's, right? I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. But at the same time, it doesn't limit you because of that, right? Like, you can literally, like, wander into, like, level 20 territory if you so wish and get the shit kicked out of yourself. But that's based off of your... you know, your experience and how much time you want to put it into the game. But even then, like, you could very well, like, experience that if you so wish. And still be capable of downing, like, enemies that may even be, like, five levels, you know, like, above you. And still feel like you're able to accomplish that just with the use of strategy. And that's one of the things that I love about Horizon is that, you know, strategically speaking, you can do a lot with the tools that they give you. Like, it might sound weird because they only have, like... X number of like arrow type, you know, kind of implements and stuff, but there's so much utility for each weapon, including like all the RPG aspects that, you know, that is, you know, of the three, like if you ask me like right now, which one of the three I'd probably, you know, come back to play, I would probably say Horizon would be the first of the three.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed the game, but not nearly that much.
Okay. Because you just left Nora, right?
I'm level like 44 in that game.
Oh shit! Okay, I didn't know like how far you were in the game. So, but
I got to the Frozen Wilds.
Oh, so wait, how far are you in the actual story of the game? Did you get the big reveal already?
I don't know if it was the big reveal, but
it's basically like a cutscene that plays on hologram on top of this building.
Yes, I did see
that. Okay, that is one of the big reveals, yes.
Okay.
Okay. That's pretty cool. It's tough to talk about because both of us haven't played the game in a while, so.
Yeah. I will say that like the story of the game, I think, starts off on the wrong foot.
Yes, I remember you saying that.
It does, but I think like as it goes on, it gets more interesting. And I guess I shouldn't say it's the story per se; it's more the world building. If you mm-hmm. think about it,
yeah,
because it's not necessarily the story itself, but rather your understanding of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. Once you figure out like how the apocalypse went down, you mm-hmm. know, it's like, oh, okay, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, because they tuck that pretty far in the back of the game, right? Like, in terms of, like, the actual story progression. Because once that big reveal happens and what really happened to the world, which is the scene that I was describing to you, that's when you're like, oh, shit! You know, that's when you mm-hmm. basically realize everything that's happened. So, you know, and that to me, like, is really fascinating. As far as Frozen Wilds go, not sure if, you know, if you want to go in there, but if you're already in there, might as well, I guess. But like,
why, you didn't care for it?
No, I did it after I finished the game, which to me, like, it actually became more doable. Because the weird thing about the Frozen Wilds is that it's allegedly like around 30 level, between level 30 or 40 or some shit. But some of the enemies, like some of their behavioral patterns are freaking like killer, man. Like, no pun
intended. Okay, so you recommend doing it after you beat the game?
Yes.
Or like right, or like, or at least like, I'm guessing right before the final mission.
I mean, I'm this is not a spoiler, but basically when you finish the game, it'll return you back to like a state where you can explore the world again. So okay. Okay. Basically don't even worry about it. Finish the game, you'll be able to explore Frozen Wilds immediately after that. So there you go.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. But anyways, so yeah, like that's my take on it. Obviously, like, it's up to you if you want to play Ease, because I know you're a big Ease fan, so, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking back, actually, like, so there's another game that I left unfinished that I should go back to. So it's Horizon, Ease Alceta, and the Odin Sphere remake.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. That's another long game.
So I when I played that one, see, I actually beat the PS2 version when it came out and loved it. But like looking back, the PS2 version is janky.
Is it
really janky?
I have both versions, so I mean,
you might as well throw away the PS2 version.
Oof. Okay. All right.
That's how janky it is, especially when you compare it to the remake. The remake replaces it.
Okay.
Right. Like, because it's the same story. The story has been untouched. The graphics are not exactly the same. They have been improved.
Okay.
But if you played it, you'll still feel like, yeah, these are the same graphics, even though they're technically better. Like right. They were able to strike this like really perfect balance of like looking and feeling like the old game, but looking better.
Okay.
And the gameplay, which was the biggest sticking point of the original Odin Sphere, is massively overhauled.
I see.
So they've added like combos, they've added a skill tree system when you level up and you can, you know, earn new moves. They've added a like fighting game-esque system of how you assign your skills.
Wow.
So like if you want, you can just like hold up and press circle to do a move. Or if you're a cool guy, you can do quarter circle, you know, square to do a special move instead.
Okay.
Or like, you know, some of the moves get pretty complicated, and I actually sometimes I'm like, man, where did I assign to what? And I had to like pause, and like it felt like I was playing like a fighting game because I'm like, oh, what, how do you do this move again? Like,
sounds like my bouts with Soul Calibur 6. Ugh.
But like the thing is, it think of it as, yeah, kind of like a fighting game with like all the different inputs, but you get to choose what moves they are. So let's say you don't like quarter circle square for Hadouken, you know, you could have made it a Shoryuken instead.
Right.
But obviously it's whatever character you're playing as in Odin Sphere.
Right.
So yeah, it's a great remake. Okay. You play as five different characters. I had beaten it as the first character, the Valkyrie.
Right.
So the second one you play as a, like the little bunny guy, with the sword. So I need to finish his story.
I think I'll probably play that in May next year, because, and the reason why I say that is because that seems to
very
be,
specific.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of next year right now, and in the next few weeks, I'm probably going to get, you know, to review like Persona 3 Dancing and Persona 5 Dancing. So that's two fucking games, by the way, that I have to freaking review.
I have less than zero interest in those games.
That's kind of like why, you know, it's kind of curious to me is like I posted about it on Twitter and only one person basically said like, oh, you're not the only one that's interested in it. And I'm like, yeah, but we're the only two people interested in it.
Well, if this gives you any comfort, I am interested in hearing what you have to say about it, simply because I don't want to play them.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. So there's that, right? So that's technically December-ish or whatever. One of the games I'm currently playing is World of Final Fantasy. I do want to finish that because I do want to write a review on that. Mind you, not Maxima. I just want to play the raw World of Final Fantasy, okay? Because it's a $16 freaking upgrade for Maxima. Holy shitballs for a two-year-old game. Anyways, and then in January, well, January, oof, what is in January? Oh, Resident Evil 2 Remake.
Yes!
And Kingdom Hearts 3. Same month. Yeah.
Wow, okay, I didn't realize it. Same month.
Really? You did not realize this? Yeah, by the way, they're both in the same month.
Yeah, wow. January. Yeah. Next year's looking pretty good, I gotta say.
February, I'm looking forward to Anthem because, you know, like, it's BioWare. I want to give them another chance, so I'll give them this chance. And then March, oh, yeah, look at that. Devil May Cry 5, Sekiro, you know,
Sekiro!
And a whole bunch of other stuff. And
dude, is 2019 the next 2017?
I don't think so yet, and I say yet because
it's shaping up to be
I hope so, because the thing that that makes 2017 really special is that there are a ton, like more than two games, like each month that people can look forward to, right? If you look at every single month in the first quarter of 2017, there was something. And you can't beat a console launch in March. I'm sorry. With Zelda, that's very difficult to beat. You know,
yeah,
that's why
2017 was pretty special.
Yes, exactly. And that's why, like I say, like it's going to be really difficult for 2019 to beat that. But, you know, you have some good games.
I'm just saying the pedigree so far.
Yeah,
it's pretty tasty.
No, yeah, no, I do not deny that. Absolutely not. Days Gone got pushed to April. I'm probably one of the few people that care about that game, but I want to give it a shot. You know, like it's an earnest, probably one of the more honest games to come out because they're not really like, you know, kind of being shy about it. So that's
you know that it's the same developer as Bubsy 3D?
Do you know it's the same developer as Siphon Filter?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's those guys too. So after Bubsy 3D, they did do other things, many successful things. So, you know, like if you want to go that route, the fucking guys who made Tony Hawk made like Apocalypse with like Bruce Willis.
I played that game.
I'm sorry.
I beat that game.
Again, I'm sorry. but yeah, like so that's why it's May, right? Because really there isn't anything in May. I mean, I guess maybe Rage, but I'm not really interested in that game anymore. Like, I'm like, it's not co-op. Fuck it. I don't really care about it.
But didn't Andrew WK and his band not convince you to buy it at E3?
No.
Don't you have any love for Andrew WK?
I have a lot of love for Doom Eternal, which is not coming out in May next year. Possibly it'll be a fall release, but that game, nah. And even Doom Eternal, sad to say, I'm going to wait until like Black Friday next year in order to get that game half off. Because the problem with the original Doom is that it kept on getting slashed by 50% every single month. And I'm like, so basically anybody who bought this game at full price just got suckered into, you know, buying it early for the sake of being early. Great. Okay.
I think, it's because id Games, especially Doom, like, they always sell like hotcakes, so they can afford to just be like, put that on sale. Why not?
Yeah, no kidding. No, totally. Totally. Okay, so I actually have a few things that I want to talk about. I know we kind of are trying to segue using fighting games and stuff, but I'm actually going to veer away from that. Well, actually, I can segue this into fighting games, because I don't know if you know, but about a month or two ago, the Tetris World Championships happened. Did you know that there was a fucking Tetris World Championship?
I did not.
Okay, so it's commentated by this other guy that I don't know, but this other guy named James Chen who commentates for fighting games. And so he literally like commentates the freaking championship as if he's commentating a goddamn fighting game. Now, mind you, the Tetris that they play, there's variations of Tetris they play, but they play the NES one. Do you know what the NES one is? There is no versus mode in that one. So they literally are playing old school for high score.
Interesting.
Think about that. So, and the thing is that's crazy is that the speed in which they do things, man, it is so fast. Apparently, the new champion, which by the way, unseated the 3-time champion of Tetris World Championship, by the way, or maybe more than that. I have to check my facts. Is this 14 or 15-year-old Wunderkind who mastered this technique of moving Tetris blocks by basically like using two fingers to tap a direction so that he can actually move the Tetris blocks faster than, you know, what, you know, using one finger will allow, which is fucking insane to think that there are Tetris techniques that we are still figuring out in 2018. It's insane, right?
I think it's pretty awesome that like people are still figuring out new things about freaking Tetris of all things.
Right. Which actually, go ahead.
I was going to say like that probably goes like far beyond what even like the creator came up with.
Exactly. And did you know that there's actually kind of like a, you know, the Tetris company actually like sanctions the rules and stuff like that? By the way, this is the Tetris company is a holding company that is owned by Hank Rogers and Alexey Pajitnov, the guy who of course made Tetris and stuff. So they basically have like some rule sets and stuff, what's official and what's not.
That's
Yeah,
that's really cool. And then real quick, I just want to say there is an excellent video by the gaming historian that talks about the history of Tetris.
Yes, I watched that.
It's awesome.
It's really good.
After you're done listening to this podcast, highly recommend.
Yeah, it's about an hour. It's pretty long, but as documentaries go, this one's really freaking good. It's incredible. You will learn things about Tetris, the game, and the licensing battles it's had more than what you might want to know about Tetris. But it's a really engaging documentary. Because I'll tell you what, Daniel, that's the first like gaming historian documentary that I actually sat down and watched, and I'm really happy I did. It's really informative and really entertaining.
He makes good stuff. He's one of my favorite YouTubers.
Yeah, definitely. So the reason why I wanted to kind of bring that up, Daniel, is because over the past weekend, and you probably have seen on my YouTube channel that I posted, is that there was a demo for Tetris Effect that came out over the weekend and was only playable until November 5th. It was a limited time demo. It was online enabled. And so do you know anything about this game? I mean, I'm sure you probably haven't looked at anything about this because, you know, you're probably thinking Tetris and stuff, but
I've heard of it and I've heard some people raving about it. And I'm like, is this really that great? It's just Tetris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you know Rez and Space Channel 5 and Luminous and these games that I'm mentioning right now?
I know of them. I haven't played any of them.
But are you aware of what they are, like what they do that's different than most games, quote unquote?
They're like very stylized.
Okay, so I need to kind of give you the quick 411 here. So
okay,
Tetsuya Mizuguchi, who's the guy who made all these games, has a knack for synesthesia. And synesthesia is defined as the interplay of visuals and feelings and emotion and music. So in other words, his work deals with a lot of interplay between different senses, including touch and all that stuff. Space Channel 5 is not a good example of that because, I mean, it is literally a music game with occasional appearances by Michael Jackson. But the other game that he made after Space Channel 5 was called Rez. And one of the most famous things that we remember about Rez when it was released on the Japanese Dreamcast is that it came with a peripheral called the Trance Vibrator. Let that sink in for a second. A Trance Vibrator.
Game came with a vibrator?
Yes. In fact, the crazy thing about that is that, you know, at the time, I mean, obviously the Dreamcast had rumble and stuff, but it didn't have like the kind of granular rumble that, you know, we have today, right? So the Trance Vibrator basically would thump and grow in the beat based off of like what's happening on screen. But And really, like, Rez is kind of like this space shooter, kind of like Panzer Dragoon or Axelay or even Star Fox to some weird-ass degree. I know Star Fox and Panzer are not the same games, but the kind of perspective and what they do, i.e. shooting, is kind of similar in that sense. So Rez is like that. But the main difference is that Rez, every time you shoot and every time you do something, the actual music and sound effects are blended into the actual music itself. Meaning, you don't hear explosions, but you hear more notes added to the actual song. And so, in a way, you are also both the player, who is basically adding more notes to the song, and also the composer of the song that you're listening to. Does that make sense?
That sounds cool.
Yeah. So all his games from Rez onward have been something to that effect. Luminous, which is basically like, you know, born from the PSP, was actually born because he couldn't get the Tetris rights back when the PSP came out. And if you look at Luminous, it's got like the same four block that Tetris has. And so he literally made Luminous in response to not being able to make a Tetris game. And of course, he also made Child of Eden, which uses the, you know, the that weird like motion sensing thing that Microsoft had for the Xbox 360, which will go nameless because it's not doesn't really work that well. But then now, fast forward to 2018, he gets the rights to Tetris. And, you know, apparently this game has been made for about like 2 or 3 years. In fact, Tetsuya Mizuguchi actually approached Hank Rogers in making this game. And Hank Rogers basically proposed to him that he would like to make a game that was very lifestyle, like very like Zen, so that any, you know, no matter like what kind of Tetris player you are, whether you're competitive, you just want to relax, or you just want to chill, or be more, help you get more focused, like that, that Tetris game would do exactly that. Tetris Effect. Yeah, Tetris Effect is the product of that conversation.
Crazy. This sounds really interesting.
It is. I mean, let me... I don't want to delude you guys who are listening, and to you, Daniel. This is Tetris, okay? This is not like... But what this guy does with Tetris is pretty fucking amazing. So imagine all the things that I mentioned to you, right? With the shooting and stuff, with Rez. But even when you press a button in Tetris Effect, that it adds more notes to the music. And it's just not also just adding notes, but it adds a melody to it that, you know, depending on the way that you move the blocks, whether it's in sequence or one after the other, it actually adds more beats to the song, so it adds a little bit more flavor. And of course, when the Tetris block lands, it adds a little bit more flourish to the song. So you are literally not just playing Tetris, but you're creating this soundscape that is absolutely incredible. That, you know, like me being like a dumbass when it comes to composing songs, i.e. I can't, you know, is able to create amazing music just by, again, playing Tetris. Doesn't that sound appealing to you? It's so crazy, right? Like the,
it's
like,
pretty neat.
Yeah, and mind you, he is the only guy that has done something like this. Like, this is has been his life's work, to infuse gameplay with musical creation and visuals and all that stuff. So, okay, so obviously you know how to play Tetris. You make a line from left to right in the arena, it clears, right? One of the mechanics that I didn't know that was actually like really interesting is that you can hold a piece now. Like, so like that, let's say you got like the straight line piece and stuff like that. You can actually like store that for use later. And if you press like the button again, it swaps it with the current one that you're using. Apparently that has been a standard for most Tetris games. I didn't know that that was a standard until I talked to a bunch of people who play Tetris recently. But there is an interesting mechanic that I think you will also appreciate, that also, as expected, does something to the music as well. It's called Zone. And Zone basically is a meter that builds up on the lower left corner of the arena, where the more lines you build up, the more the zone fills up. It's like a super meter in a fighting game. Now, here's the crazy part. If you activate the zone, all of your blocks that you have on the top that's slowly dropping will stop dropping. And you can, and for a limited amount of time, you could basically like put those pieces without the pressure of those blocks dropping anywhere you want, provided, of course, it's not like some weird off place. Basically, like, it buys you more time. So like, if you're a beginner, you could buy more time to basically think of where to put your, you know, your Tetris blocks, right? You with me so far?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But if you are a veteran, each time you clear a line, that cleared line drops all the way to the bottom of the arena and won't be marked as cleared. There is a possibility that while time is stopped using the zone, that you can clear 20 or more lines if you're really good while in the zone. And it's called a perfect Tris, which is a brand new mechanic that, you know, no other Tetris... Well, I don't want to say no one ever has. I think there was one or two other games that have had it. But this is literally like, you know, like the big mechanic. Yeah, it's the big mechanic of this game is the zone. And what's kind of cool, like when you activate the zone, like what happens is like your sound, like if you play this with headphones, it's like you're getting sucked into a different dimension. So the music kind of fades in the background, gets kind of like kind of like muffled and stuff like that, like as if you're literally like being enveloped in like a, you know, like a soundproof room or something. And you can literally, it helps you kind of focus. And the more lines you make, the more crazy the visuals become. And so that's kind of the new mechanic of this new Tetris game. But here's the thing too. Most Tetris games, you know, basically force you to basically play from level one all the way up to little, you know, however you deal with, right? You know, that's typical Tetris, right? In fact, what was the last Tetris game you played?
Puyo Puyo Tetris.
Okay. So basically Puyo Puyo Tetris has a similar kind of mechanic, right? You start with level one, you play as much as you can until you die, right? I mean,
well, I mainly played it like with my family, so mm-hmm. we were just playing like versus modes.
Okay, so this game doesn't have a versus mode, by the way. This is all points again as well. But the single player aspect of this, and this is going to sound interesting to you, is called Journey. And so Journey is not like, hey, you start with level one and it gets harder and harder and harder. It is literally meant to evoke a journey in real life to make you actually feel emotions. I know this sounds very hoity-toity, but that's kind of like how they described it. Because, like, you know, the way that they described it is like, you know, like journeys in real life, there are peaks and valleys and stuff. So sometimes things can get harder, but then there's a big payoff at the end if you work really hard. And maybe there's like a really tough, you know, kind of part in this. And then now it's like, you know, you basically like see something. You know, the most difficult thing to talk about Journey is the way that it feels and the way that it makes, you know, Tetris feel unique. Because the way that Journey works is that there are several sequences of stages. There could be three stages, there could be four stages. Each stage has its own soundtrack. It also has its own visuals. And the gameplay is modified so that there's a very specific intention of like, hey, I'm in this section, I should expect to maybe get more blocks of this type or something like that. Does that make sense? Like, mm-hmm. So it's like giving each level more character, right? So for example, the very first level that you play, you're underwater. And so literally there's the game carries this metaphor where, like, you know, and mind you, each area has three stages for the music. So at first the music is kind of very calm, and then the second one more instruments happen, and then third there's more instruments plus vocals. And of course still the music basically gets augmented the more you do your Tetris thing and stuff. So it's really crazy. If you're curious about this, by the way, I have like a really handy 5 to 6 minute video on my channel at My Backlog Battle about Tetris Effect. I actually have like a section of it where I actually play you know, like and kind of show you like what that means to play Tetris Effect and stuff, because you'll notice when I'm moving the blocks there's different notes to play. And even I try to play it in tune and rhythm to the song, and of course it matches it, which is also satisfying. So there's that, and then you get to the next area where you're literally like in, you know, almost like hacking something, and then you get to like the third and final area in Journey where it's literally like almost like tribal music and stuff. So basically, like, there's three different visual landscapes and there's three different soundscapes. And also, you know, like when I get to that third area, I notice the pieces get harder, like, to deal with. Like, for some reason, like, I notice, like, I'm like, I suddenly am not getting any of the pieces that I want. You know, like, you get that feeling when you play Tetris sometimes. But in this one, it's like, yeah, you do feel that. You're like, I need that, like, long, you know, log piece, the four piece that's long that you can just insert there. I'm not getting it. And you kind of feel that way the more you play Journey. And so, because it's in different sequences, after you beat that last area, the third area and stuff, then in the demo that I played, it's over. Like, it's not going to continue on to the next sequence. It is right. Literally chunks of time where you can play Tetris in a very meaningful way. Also, you can play this in VR, which even immerses you even more, which, you know, this sounds, again, all that I'm saying is probably hoity-toity and very, very crazy and esoteric, but it's like, you know, like, let's say, like, let me give you an example. I told you that the first level is all about, like, you know, sea creatures and jellyfish and stuff. In VR, it's obviously still that, plus all the effects are coming into your face. But the higher your Tetris blocks are in the arena, the more you'll notice your head is starting to look up and up and up because of how tall your Tetris pieces are. That's by design, because they want you to make you feel like you're losing air. So you're literally like, you know, as the, you know, and mind you, you're not going to get dizzy playing Tetris Effect on VR. It's actually really classy done. And of course, you know, the more you actually deal with your tower, the lower it gets. So you're starting to look down on the VR headset and stuff.
But I just find the idea of playing Tetris in VR kind of funny.
It is weird, right? Honestly, I scoffed at that myself, because I'm like, what the fuck? Like, how is this going to be any different? But it did add a bit to it. And there's actually a really good video by Nick Robinson, He's, you know, really good YouTuber. He basically had a Tetris champ play the game. And, you know, he, you know, like, and it's actually like, I think I want to say 10 or 18 minutes or something like that. And then, of course, the guy, the Tetris champ asked him if he could play it in VR. And the thing that's crazy is that Nick Robinson asked the developer, saying like, is he doing better like in VR? Because here's the thing that I didn't know, that I forgot, and something that the video actually talks about. There is no lag in PlayStation VR. So literally the guy was playing better because he was playing in a lagless setup in VR. Also, it helped him focus more. He actually got interviewed after that and said, like, I feel more focused because he had the headphones on and he had like the headset. Like, there was no distractions, you know? It's really crazy to think about, right?
Yeah, that I don't know. I just I'm still trying to wrap my head around playing Tetris in VR.
Yeah, I know. Totally. So, I mean, I know I can wax poetic about this game a lot more and stuff like that, but this is just a weekend demo, and the actual game comes out this Friday. So I'm, you know, you could bet your ass I'm probably going to play more of it. But again, if you want to see like an example of this, and I do encourage you, Daniel, to check it out, because seeing that I'm not forcing you to buy Tetris Effect. I just want you to see, you to watch like what I mean by the gameplay and making you, you know, make the music of the game and stuff like that. So
I'll at least check out like a video or two.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, like, I mean, sadly, that's all really like the only things we can talk about right now, because I mean, we have a lot to talk about, but let's save that for next time. You know? But before we go,
we've given you a beefy episode.
It's quite beefy. I think so. I think it is. But Daniel, do you want to, you know, share with us like what you'll be up to and what you've been working on and where we can find you?
Of course. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, is at Shintai Reviews. And if you want to subscribe to me on YouTube, I think if you just look up either Shintai Reviews or Daniel Santos, yeah, you should be able to find my channel. As for what I'm working on, I actually beat Shadow of the Colossus again.
Again.
For the sake of recording. Now, it was actually kind of a blessing in disguise that I did this, because one of the crucial parts of my piece is that I put a lot of emphasis on the fact that Wander doesn't have a reaction when he sees the first Colossus. Mm-hmm. This is something that's like seared into my mind, right? Like, this is like a memory that I have that I know for a fact is there.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I replayed the game again and during the remake, I see that Wander is reacting to the first Colossus, and I'm like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Whoa, no, this is wrong. No, am I crazy? And then I was like, okay, hold on a second. So I popped in the PS3 version, which is basically a straight port of the PS2 version.
Mm-hmm.
And Wander doesn't react in that version.
Okay.
So I actually had to like add a little section in the script, in the review, where I basically have to, for the sake of transparency, I point out that, hey, in the PS4 remake, you have to know that this was made by Bluepoint. It was not made by Team Ico. Mm-hmm. So this more than likely is like some creative liberty on their part, and that the analysis is going to be based on the original version of the game, because I feel that was like the, you know, that was the version that Team Ico created. I feel that obviously that's more reflective of what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even though the remake is otherwise pretty much one-to-one in almost every other respect, I'm going to go based on the original.
Right. And it just makes more sense to do it that way. So when can we expect the video?
If all goes well, Saturday.
Nice. Looking forward to it, definitely.
Yes. Okay.
Yep. Okay, so as far as my projects go, there's a bunch of games that I am playing right now that I do want to make reviews out of, but certainly one of the games that I'm going to be playing a lot of this weekend is Tetris Effect when it finally comes out. But if you want to check out the video that I made for Tetris Effect, which is, you know, an impressions piece, it kind of gives you an idea of how crazy the visuals are, how good the music is, by the way, because, man, it is kind of poppy a little bit, Daniel, but I think you still like it. It matches the feel of the game, let's put it that way. It is on youtube.com/mybacklogbattle. Again, that is youtube.com/mybacklogbattle. And of course, if you want to talk about video games, you know, me and Daniel and stuff, we're on Twitter. My Twitter is twitter.com/mybacklogbattle. And I may have a video or two online, you know, kind of, you know, cooking up for next week. But yeah, I'm playing a lot of games right now. So stay tuned for that. There's going to be a deluge of videos in the next few weeks leading up to the new year. So just teasing you a little bit, you know. But yeah. So anyways, Daniel, do you have anything else to say before we go?
Not really.
I know, I'm putting you on the spot because I don't normally do this. So anyways.
I was like, what the hell do you want me to say?
Yeah, where did this come from? Okay. All right, guys. Well, that about does it for today. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode. So we'll see you guys next week, and happy gaming.
Take care.